G'day, I'm Rob.
And I'm Dave.
And you're listening to The Doctor Who Show, wrapping up the month of December. Christmas has already happened. It's all happening, Dave. Hello.
Hello, Rob. I am taking a break from the Boxing Day test, as I'm sure are you. And yes. We're here to talk about Doctor Who one last time for 2020.
One last time for 2020, but we'll be back very, very early in the new year to talk Revolution of the Daleks.
That's absolutely right. Rob, how are you?
Last time we gave a sort of a COVID update, we're saying things are great. Things maybe aren't so great in New South Wales at the moment, but we may have it under control. It's all a bit up in the air at the moment.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I'm doing what people do over the course of December, having some time off, catching up with family and friends. Very aware that, as we said last month, there are people in the world, particularly in the UK and in the US, who are in a much different position to what we are at this time for Christmas. And we're very, very aware of that. And once again, we hope the next hour and a half or so is just some fun escape from all of that, and that 2021 is going to be better.
Absolutely. Work is over for the day. We're recording here. It's good times. I've had an adult beverage in the in salute to the season, and I'm good to go.
Right. Well, I think I'm leading us off with the news, so I will do just that. And that is that inevitably, within a couple of days of us recording our November episode, as we fully expected, the trailer for Revolution of the Daleks did drop.
Can I jump in and say, whenever we need a trailer to drop, we should just talk about it on the show, and then it will happen about 2 days later.
Yes, almost inevitably between recording and drop. The trailers always come out. It happened again this time. Rob, my one sentence takeaway from this is that it looks exciting, but every element of it looks like something I've seen before. What do you think?
I'm hoping it's great. I really, really am, based on what we've seen. And what we've seen isn't much. I admit that as well.
That's exactly right. We've seen very little. I haven't been watching it more than a couple of times. I haven't been analysing it. I think I've said many times on the show, I'm not into that. I think that you analyse the show when you see it. There's no point really trying to get ahead of what it might be doing because we've seen so little. And the fact that it all looks very familiar isn't necessarily a bad thing, because it's Doctor Who, and that's often the case. There are many times that Doctor Who has gone back to the well or reused ideas. It's how it uses them that matter. So this could be a very exciting, fun adventure with some really nice ideas and some new twists on some old takes. Or it could be Doctor Who 101. Who knows?
Look, it's very interesting. And in breaking news, we don't even have this in our show notes, there has been an additional scene filmed for this episode. Something that hadn't been filmed whenever they filmed this. When did they film this? A year ago? It was a long time ago.
It feels like that, yeah.
Yeah, they have actually filmed recently a new scene to add to this. And people are saying, oh, it's regeneration. I'm thinking, it's not regeneration, you idiot. They're already filming Jodie's new series. She's in it. You know, she's not regenerating. But it is something. They have filmed something, we have been told.
Interesting. Do you think that it is a reference to COVID?
I'd hope it's not. I don't like when TV shows start bringing in stuff from week to week, unless it was that show. What was that show? It was a mockumentary of a TV.
Are you thinking of Drop the Dead Donkey?
I'm thinking of Drop the Dead Donkey, yes. It was fine for them to do it, but anything else, no, because it just dates like about 2 weeks later. It's just ridiculous.
Well, it does, and I've in fact got the DVDs of Drop the Dead Donkey, and before each episode there's a little voice that comes on and says, in the news this week was a reference to, and they're explaining all the topicality because, you know, stuff like Thatcher or John Major or Tony Blair you kind of get, but, yes. You know, this is the week that Robert Maxwell fell overboard or something. You go, oh, that's right, that did happen, and so you get the jokes. I don't like that in Doctor Who. I think you look back at a lot of stuff, film, TV that was produced around 9/11, and some of which try to directly reference that, and now you watch it now and you just go, wow, this just feels really dated. It doesn't have the timelessness. So I think neither of us want it to be that, but it would not shock me if it was something like that.
I've got a joke.
Okay.
What's 6 inches long and wet?
Go on.
Robert Maxwell's cigar.
You've been holding that back from about 1990, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Let's move on in the news, because I've got something Revolution of the Daleks related.
Please.
And that's that, Look, way back in March of this year, so we're going back a long way now, Nick Briggs talked about the title Revolution of the Daleks and told Radio Times, "It fits perfectly, but not in the way you'd think. I can see why they've called it that." And I remember reading that at the time, I thinking, what could that mean? And in more recent times, Chibnall has said that it definitely has more than one meaning, and he thinks we'll all understand it when we see the episode. So this has got me thinking about the title Revolution of the Daleks, Dave, and my take, my hot take, which I'll give to you now. I think the obvious one is that it's a revolution in terms of rebellion. The Daleks are in some kind of rebellion. That could fit. Chibnall has said that the title can also relate to the non-Dalek characters, so that's interesting. Is there a rebellion on Earth in the UK? I don't know. It's meant to be tricksy, so do we assume the obvious, or do we assume it's a revolution in terms of maybe like an evolution, like they've turned full circle? Are they going back to the start of the Dalek story? Is this a new kind of genesis for them? It might be along those lines, but I don't know. But apparently it has more than one meaning, this revolution.
Yeah, all of those options certainly crossed my mind. The one that I most quickly latched onto, because I'm a fan of 60s Who, was something in the style of Power of the Daleks, where the Daleks are used by humans in a revolution. That's an option as well. I don't know. And I think the one thing that we really don't know is to what extent the Doctor plot will interact with the Earth plot. Is the Doctor in prison for 5 minutes and then comes and joins them? Is she there for the whole episode? And is it that the Doctor arrives 2/3 of the way through to save the day? Is it that there are parallels between them? I don't know. Is there a revolution on the prison planet that may or may not be Shada? I don't know.
You're absolutely right. It could be any of those things. If I was a betting man, I'm going to say she's not going to spend long on the prison planet. It's just sort of like an intro thing, and then she moves away from it.
That's my guess as well, but the trailer is certainly directing us to not think that.
No, that's right.
So moving on from Revolution of the Daleks to the post-Graham and Ryan world, which has been very highly publicised. I don't think that is a spoiler anymore. It's not a spoiler if the BBC's put it in everything they've done. Nerdist had a very interesting article that highlighted something that just hadn't occurred to me, and that is that we are about to get the first ever all-female TARDIS crew. And there was a moment of me sitting there going, oh, I wonder if that's true. Then going, well, if all the other doctors have been male, of course it is true. Like, I don't actually have to run through the list of companions to work that one out.
Yeah.
And it is. And it's a very interesting thing. I will ask, I'll get your view in a moment, Rob, because I'm kind of a bit neutral on this. I don't sort of sit there and go, this is a wonderful event that the show needed to have. Nor am I sitting there going, well, the lack of male identity characters is going to destroy the show. I don't think either of those is necessarily true. I come back to what I've always thought, which is if there is something interesting and good to do with the Dr. Yaz team, then that is a good thing. If there's not, then it's a bad thing. And that it's not a bad thing because they're both female. It's a bad thing because Yaz is so far an underdeveloped character, and if she remains so, that is a bad thing. Now, I don't know whether this is coming from an official word, that there is going to be no new companion introduced over the next season, or whether there will be, or it's just speculation. But it is an interesting point that they will at least leave as the first ever female TARDIS team. Rob, you've got some thoughts I know you wanted to bring up.
I do. I'll just say briefly, though, that yes, I mean, this all-female crew, I looked at that and I thought, yeah, it is. Okay, great. You know, and it didn't really faze me in any sort of way, either it's destroying the show or it's a wonderful thing. I just accepted it. I thought, well, this is okay, great.
Yeah.
As you say, Yaz has been underused, so let's hope she gets used a bit better. Having said that, though, my issue with this is a side sort of street to it all, and that's the issue of people online shipping the Doctor and Yaz. Now, I'm not much of a fan of anyone shipping the Doctor and a companion in any other era. I mean, it was shown fairly overtly with, you know, I guess Tennant and Rose and with Capaldi particularly and Riversong. But beyond that, I'd like to think they're the exceptions, not the rule. I don't like to think of the Doctor as always needing or wanting to have a relationship with the companions. Like, oh, here I am, 1,000 years old. I'll go out with a 19-year-old. Like, that, it just seems ridiculous to me. But shippers, they're an odd lot. You know, if I can use Star Wars as an example, there were the Raylos, the ones who wanted Kylo Ren and Rey to get together. And I guess they got their way in the end, to some degree. But it was still very weird. You know, this dude who wants to kill Rey all the time. And the shippers are like, oh, look, if they just kissed, it would be wonderful. And I'm thinking, what a weird message this is sending, you know. Because to speak seriously for a moment, this is a guy who wants to kill this woman. And people are saying, they should just get together. Ladies, he's the guy to get with. It was just a strange message. You know, it defies all logic and common sense, but a lot of shipping seems to do that. And here with the Doctor and Yaz, I think, yeah, the Doctor and Yaz is a TARDIS team. Sure, let's go with that. Do they need to be a couple, though? This just seems just weird, just unnecessary to me.
Look, I go further than you, Rob. I am not just not a fan of the Doctor and the companion being shipped. I loathe the whole concept of the Doctor being capable of being shipped. I am very, very happy with the Doctor being a completely sexless individual. The Doctor for me is the Doctor of City of Death, where he refers to Countess Scaglione as a beautiful woman, probably. That's my Doctor. I didn't like it when they kind of did it with Tennant and Rose. I kind of ignored it as much as I could and pretended it wasn't happening. And whether that makes me the worst sort of nerdy fanboy, meh, I don't care. It's just not what I want in the show. It's not so much that I don't want the Doctor and Yaz to be in a relationship. I don't want the Doctor to be in a relationship, full stop.
Yeah, look, I'm much the same, because if they just did it with every companion, it would just be creepy. Look, let's just leave the Doctor fairly sexless.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we could go down a whole rabbit hole of the Tennant stuff, but that's not what we're here to do for this one. Maybe when we do a Tennant era retrospective, I think we'll be a part of it, but neither of us are a fan. And Rob, you've got the last piece of news.
I do. And I love this. I love this so much, because this is Chris Eccleston. You know, we've spoken about him recording for Big Finish, and he has now actually started recording for Big Finish. He's posted pictures of himself holding up the script. He's talked on the Big Finish podcast. And one of the big quotes, which I'll read to you now, listeners, he said to Nick Briggs, who was talking to him on that podcast, you know, I felt that you, as in Nick Briggs, understood what he was all those years ago. And it was like putting on an old pair of shoes, running shoes, you know, doing the scripts. You get the sense of somebody immersed in the lore of the show. And he realized that in the past that he was playing Stephen Moffat, he was playing Russell T. Davis, he was playing Rob Shearman. He said, you're playing all of them, their projected self as the Doctor, and that's nice. And I was reading this as an interview rather than listening to the podcast. I thought, this is just great. This is Chris Eccleston. He's back in the fold. He doesn't particularly want to play it on TV anymore, and that's fine. But he is really into doing this, you know, Big Finish stuff. And it seems like he likes the scripts and that he's thinking about the show and thinking about how when you play a script by a different writer, you're playing them because they're essentially writing themselves as the Doctor. And I thought, this is marvelous. And this is something I wouldn't have thought would happen, I don't know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, you know, let alone longer.
No, I don't think we ever really expected Christopher Eccleston to come back in the, certainly the short to medium term, and even now it's been a bit of a surprise. So I'm glad he's enthusiastic. I will check it out in one form or another sometime after they're released, and we'll see what happens. But I know a lot of people are big fans of this and very keen, and I know you're one of them, Rob.
Yeah, look, Big Finish in general, I'm on and off with. In fact, I might talk about something later in the episode which will really show that. But with regard to this, I think I will pre-order this. I think I'll be there on day one for this. And that's the most excited I've ever been about anything Big Finish has ever done.
Well, I will be very keen to hear your thoughts, because I will be waiting to hear what people think before I decide to purchase them or not.
Fair enough. Well, that leads us into mini topics, Dave, and I think you have the first one for us.
Look, just a little one. It has been a very busy month and not a lot of time to watch many things, but Doctor Who particularly. But I did sit down and watched all of Paradise Towers a couple of weekends ago. I was inspired by our friends at the Diddly Dumb podcast doing their listener poll results episode on the McCoy era, and I realised I hadn't watched Paradise Towers for a long time, and I've got a soft spot for it. And I just wanted to make the comment about watching it, because watching it, I sat there and I thought, there are so many good ideas in here, and there are so many nice bits. There are some very nice costumes. There's some very nice moments. There are definitely some good concepts, some very clever little script pieces. There are also some utterly, utterly, utterly terrible performances, some utterly terrible choices, and some utterly terrible direction. And it is perhaps one of the most bizarre stories to watch, just seeing all of these bits come together in a way that just doesn't quite work. I mean, there's a couple of young actors and actresses in there that you sort of go, okay, we get this. It was very early in your career, and you were still getting the hang of your craft. You're not that, it wasn't that good at performance. Richard Dreyer doesn't have that excuse.
No.
But again, it just shows how indifferent the director was at this point, because there is stuff that I get what Dreyer is doing. He said in the documentary that goes on the DVD that he was playing the chief caretaker in a certain way. He made certain decisions, and particularly when he's been taken over by Kragnong, he's playing it as though an entity has taken over a body they're not used to. So they're not quite used to speaking with that mouth, and they're not quite used to moving with those limbs, and they're sort of getting the hang of using this body again. I thought that's a really interesting acting choice, but it doesn't come across that way in the performance.
No, it
and
doesn't.
It's just such an obscene tragedy that the director didn't, after one or two takes, or even after the rehearsals, for God's sake, just go, hey, Richard, what's your thinking on that one? This is my thinking. Okay, this is how it's coming across. It's not working. Let's rethink that.
Yeah.
The same with a number of moments. We just sit there and go, like some of the performances, you go, right, these are veterans, and they're just doing a really good job regardless of what they're being told. You know, they can do it with their eyes shut. Others can't. It's one of the biggest shames in Doctor Who. I think the script is so clever, and there's so many nice little bits, and there's so many people trying really hard, and it just is let down by some awful bits.
I would love to see Paradise Towers filmed in a similar way to the Carl Urban Judge Dredd movie. Have you seen that, Dave?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, okay. Well, just think like a really grungy tower block that just feels scary to be in, and it's not like a BBC set from 1990.
Yeah.
Or 1987, I should say.
Yeah.
It would be a completely different thing. Of course it would. But I would just love to see it done like that. Oh, it would be fantastic.
Yeah, or even a different director from the McCoy era. I mean, if you can imagine Andrew Munro doing that, or now the guy who did Dragonfire and a couple of others and went on to work on The Bill, whose name completely escapes me.
Mm.
But yeah, there were other and better directors in the McCoy era, and I just think this was such a shame.
Fair enough. I only have one mini topic this month myself, and it's to end the year. It's been a big year. We've talked about it on every show so far. And, you know, I've picked up some new interests, like reading the Horus Heresy novels in the Warhammer universe, or I've been watching some incredibly long box sets of things like All Creatures Great and Small, or the Sherlock Holmes series with Jeremy Brett. And I haven't watched or done much with Doctor Who this month. In fact, I'd call it a Doctor Who free month, in as much as it can be when we still run the Twitter and things like that, and we talk a bit about Doctor Who. But what I realised is there's this comforting thing that Doctor Who is always there. You know, I have this shelf and every episode's on it, and I've got a ton of novels I've never read, whether it's NAs or MAs, whether it's short stories in like the Short Trips books that Big Finish did and now no longer do, or even the NSAs. You know, right now, if I want a Matt Smith Cyberman story, I know I've got an NSA about that. I can go and read it right now. I love knowing it's there, but I don't need to read it right now, at least not this month. And, you know, it's the same for Big Finish. I've got, and this ties into what we were saying earlier, me and Big Finish, I've got the first 200 monthly releases they did. I've picked them up fairly cheaply over the years when they've done sales. I've hardly touched them. I've hardly delved into that 200, you know, and I've got more besides. But I know they're there. Doctor Who isn't going anywhere. I'm not the 12-year-old I was in 1987 who must have, you know, all the Doctor Who all the time. I can consume it at a much more leisurely pace. And this month, it's hardly been anything. And I'm cool with that. I know it's there. And it's a very zen-like way to finish the year, I think, Dave. And I just wanted to mention that for my mini topic.
No, that's a very lovely thought. And I will be contrasting the TV landscape now compared to way back when we get to the very last item we have in this podcast. So I'll save it for then, I think.
Okay. Well, that's the end of mini topics. It just brings us to our main topic, I guess, Dave.
Yes, so our main topic for this month, and it is one specifically designed to get a lot of listener feedback, and we have very thankfully got a lot of listener feedback, which is really positive, but it is a topic of fan reactions that surprised you. And this was simply inspired by me thinking about all those occasions where I would watch an episode of Doctor Who completely blind. You know, get up in, you know, usually a Sunday morning as it is now, or it used to be a Saturday night when they, or a Sunday night, I should say, when they were broadcast here a day after the UK and I was watching them then, or whatever the time frame. Mm-hmm. You'd watch it, you'd just form your impressions, and at some level, there's just a sense of, I enjoyed that, or I didn't enjoy that, or I loved that, or I hated that. It's just a real gut sort of feeling of what you thought about it and why. And then you go now and do something that is very particular to this era of the show, which is able to get an instant check on what the immediate fan consensus is via Twitter, via message boards, if, for those people who still go there. I gave up on them a long time ago. Yeah. Via podcasts, you know, very quickly, sort of in a day or two afterwards, there will be 3, 4, 5 podcasts that I can listen to that have reviews of episodes. And suddenly you get this sort of feeling of what the collective view of an episode was in that moment. And oftentimes you can either agree with it, or sometimes you disagree with it and you go, okay, they liked it more than me, but I get why. It might be, they liked it more than me, but a lot of people like Riversong more than I do, so I understand that. Or they didn't like that, but they don't like historical stuff, so I get I'm more likely to, you know, and that's okay. But we want to talk about those ones where you just go online or speak to friends, you go, did we watch the same episode?
Yes.
And just have a bit of fun with that concept.
Absolutely. And because it's the, you know, the Christmas season, it's New Year's, it's just great to get so many listeners commenting and hearing your views on this as well.
So, Rob, shall I kick us off?
Please, please do.
I'm going to start off with two examples, both from the new series, because obviously most of mine are, and both from the Capaldi era, but from different ends of the reaction spectrum.
Right.
So the first episode is one that I remember watching, and from the opening couple of scenes, I remember going, this is just gorgeous. The direction is lovely. This is very different direction. This is not the House Doctor Who style. And it's a really interesting adventure. It's lovingly done. It's not mind-blowingly brilliant. The conceit at the end was very interesting. I thought, in a season that's been very, very cynical, that was a really fun and enjoyable story. I really like that. I wonder what everybody else thought about The Forest of the Night.
Oh.
And I discovered it was absolutely loathed. Absolutely loathed, almost universally. And that is perhaps one of the biggest examples of where, you know, I didn't think that this was Genesis of the Daleks reincarnate, but I thought it was a great, fun little story. But people seemed to hate it. They hated the conceit. They hated the look. They hated the child actors. They hated the effects. And I just thought, wow, we didn't watch the same thing.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. That's one, you know, and I know neither of us want to go in too much and dissect each other's opinions, or particularly our listeners' opinions. But that was one I recall where it was like, I like my Doctor Who to be magical, but this is a bit too magical. You know, maybe I should just put a full stop at the end of that sentence and not go any further, but that was my feeling on it.
No, absolutely. And that's a really just a good way of summarising how sometimes a concept is either going to hit or it's going to miss. And if it misses, it's going to miss by a mile. And a lot of these things in the new series are like that, which is a good segue into my other example that I want to bring up in this moment.
Yeah.
And that is an episode that I was watching and I thought, oh no, the Capaldi Doctor is being a prick thing is back again. I really don't like that. He's being a really, really nasty guy. There's an awful J&T style piece of stunt casting. It's all a little bit silly. It's all a little bit obvious. It's all a little bit samey. And oh my goodness, they've even got like a fake timer on the screen as though this is some sort of tiresome, childish game show. This is utterly, utterly silly. And I was blown away to discover that everyone else loved Mummy on the Orient Express.
I adore that, Dave.
I know you do. I remember us disagreeing at the time. And yeah, it was one. I genuinely turned it off and thought that was absolutely ridiculous. And to this day, I think I'm the only one who doesn't like it.
It's a pretty popular Capaldi story.
Very popular Capaldi story.
Wow. Okay. I don't have an example for both. I have an example for one where I thought it was a really great episode, and I found out that wasn't the case in a lot of people's minds. It also wasn't particularly panned either. It just didn't ever seem to be as popular as I thought it was. It's from Eccleston's first series. It's Father's Day.
Yes.
Now, to me, this was one of the standout stories of Series 1. You know, it took this super-duper obvious time travel issue. You know, what if you could go back and save someone you care for, you know, and all that. And it made it real. And, you know, as the story progressed, when the TARDIS just became a box, or the Doctor was killed, or seemed to be killed, it was tense as hell. And then the conclusion that, you know, Rose's dad has to know that to fix things, he has to go and basically throw himself in front of a car and die. This is brutal. I thought, this is great. This is a really good story. And it just didn't seem to make a mark on other people. And I guess when I look back, it's because there were some really, really great stories from about halfway through Eccleston's first series, his only series. There were just great stories. So maybe it just got a bit lost. But even now, it still surprises me. I think this is much better than people sort of give it credit for.
No, I totally agree. To me, that was one of the stories that really confirmed to me that the series was back and I was going to love it, particularly coming off the back of Dalek. But you're right, it is incredibly forgotten. I don't think it's disliked. I think you're right, it's just forgotten. And I think that is because in between Rose, Dalek, Empty Child, Bad Wolf...
Yeah.
You know, it just sort of gets a little bit forgotten, and that's a shame because I think it is very good.
Yeah. Anyway, that was mine. Shall we get on to some listeners?
Yes, we've got more examples of our own, but we've got some listener ones to break us up with. And I'm going to give the first one, which is from Shane Gordon via Facebook. Thank you, Shane.
Yes.
Hello. Just heard your concept is episodes you liked, others hated, and vice versa. What a great idea. Love and Monsters I loved. Though not a fan of Dr. Light episodes, I just really enjoyed this story, but feel totally ostracized when I mention it. As for the opposite spectrum, I did not enjoy, and I hate to say this because I love Devo, is Planet of Fire. Ooh. I know a lot of people love it, but I don't. I don't hate it, I just find it a chore to watch, and I wonder if it's because I know the Master ends up surviving what looks like his ultimate doom. Anyway, love the idea for a show. Thank you for that, Shane. I think that Love and Monsters is an excellent one because there actually probably to this day is still no fan consensus on Love and Monsters.
No. But
most of the views are very strong in one direction or the other.
Yeah, look, I'll say that when I watched it, you know, in isolation of fandom, I sat there and thought, oh, wow, they're having some fun with this. This is bonkers. This is quite fun. You know, and then when I saw the online reaction, I thought, did people miss the joke? You know, were people in the UK a bit mad that, you know, a young kid got to design the monster in this episode, so they're down on it for that reason? I don't know. I don't think it's a wonderful, amazing episode, as you were saying earlier. It's not Genesis of the Daleks or anything, but I never got the hate for it, to be honest.
This is one example where I watched it with the wrong frame of mind and hated it.
Yeah,
And a couple of the things in the resolution particularly put me off. But when I went back about a year later to sort of rewatch that series, and I knew by then what the intention was, and I made sure I watched it in the right frame of mood, I took a lot more out of it. I still don't think it's great. It's not something I'm going to go back to and watch a lot. But I did find that watching it in the right mood made a very big difference to my enjoyment.
Yeah, good call. And Shane also brings up Planet of Fire, which I know you love, Dave, and I like it quite a lot too. So I've been wrapping my mind around this since Shane's comment came in on Facebook, thinking, why? How could you not like it? I mean, he brings up that the Master survives and all that sort of stuff. I was wondering whether if, you know, you try and watch this as a movie length sort of thing, it gets a bit long, maybe. That's about the best I could come up with, because I do love it.
Look, sometimes these shows just don't work for everyone, and if that doesn't work for Shane, well, that's fine. You can dislike my all-time favourite Davis, and I don't mind.
Shall we move on?
Please, next is from you, Rob.
Yes, this is Tom Turlow, who tweets at Tom Turlow. He says, Kill the Moon was a story I really liked, then discovered that everyone else absolutely loathed it. In the Forest of the Night and Nightmare in Silver were not episodes I loved, but I didn't dislike them either. I seem to be alone in that conclusion too. I remember being blown away by the Impossible Planet and Satan Pit, but was a bit nonplussed to find what seemed like a tidal wave of apathy from fandom. Although, to be fair, their reputation has improved markedly in the interim.
Well, I can reassure you, Tom Turlough, you are not alone, because I also, as I've just said, enjoyed Forest of the Night. I quite enjoyed The Nightmare in Silver. I thought it was one of the better stories of that season. But let's talk about Kill the Moon, because this is going to come up a lot.
Mm.
I also was very, very surprised by the strength of the reaction to Kill the Moon by fandom. I watched this story and I thought it was a really good story. I thought the filming on the moon itself, the location footage, was really good. I thought the build-up and the tenseness of the decision was really quite powerful. And I can remember watching that moment where Earth had to decide what it was going to do, and I thought, if Earth collectively decides to sacrifice itself for this unknown creature, I will lose all interest in this episode, because that, frankly, that would just not be believable. And it just wouldn't. And when Earth turned the lights off and said, right, no, that's it, let the creature go, because the Earth's more important, I thought, wow, that's a really realistic and tough and cynical decision, and I'm totally here for it. Even the idea of the moon being an egg, I didn't mind. The only thing that got me was that the creature lays another egg bigger than the creature itself. That just... That was a bit silly. Look, I do agree with some of the points that had this been a world other than Earth, maybe they could have got away with it a bit more in terms of suspension of disbelief, but frankly, that's too much analysis. I watched this and enjoyed it, and like you, Tom, I was surprised at not just the dislike, but this is genuinely hated by some people.
Yeah, I can't say I hate, but I certainly was disappointed by it. You've brought up, you know, the creature pooping out an egg that's bigger than itself. Clara talking to the whole Earth and getting lights turned on and off. Oh, God. And the Doctor leaving his companion in that tight spot. You know, like, well, it's your planet, you deal with it, or whatever it was. I thought, when's that ever stopped the Doctor in the past? He's always, you know, done what he thought was right for Earth. It felt like it was written by someone who didn't really get Doctor Who, to me. Because, look, there are other episodes where I'll say, oh, this is such great, you know, telefantasy, this is wonderful. But here, again, we have some telefantasy going on, but I just left nonplussed by the whole thing, Dave.
Look, fair enough. We have another from semi-regular contributor Christopher Bryant, who tweets at Chap with Wings. And Christopher says, this happens to me all the time. Some episodes I really loved on first viewing, e.g. Fear Her, Robot of Sherwood. Others I merely liked. Kill the Moon, Journey to the Centre, Sleep No More, Saranga, Orphan 55. And then I discover how much fandom seems to hate them. In some cases, I've gravitated towards fan opinion over the years, e.g. The Doctor's Daughter. But in others, I've remained steadfast. I don't get why people hate arachnids in the UK. I think people who dismiss Voyage of the Damned are crazy. Meanwhile, there are some big showy stories that people seem to love and I have serious problems with. I'm not on board with Magician's Apprentice, Asylum of the Daleks, Husbands of Riversong, or Flesh and Stone. I do sometimes agree with other fans, I promise. I love The Day of the Doctor and can't stand the Battle of Razkor Av Kolos. It's harder to remember how this relates to the classic era. My initial impressions were so long ago, plus it was less easy back then to gauge the reaction of other fans. When it comes down to it, every story will have its champions. I definitely agree with what Christopher is saying in that last part about the change in the era and that instant stuff. That's really what motivated this. And look, of all the stories he mentioned, I will agree very strongly with him on The Doctor's Daughter. That was another one that I thought was just a really fun story. I actually quite liked Donna in that, which was unusual for me. And again, I just discovered people absolutely loathe it.
Yeah, look, I'll go with that one too, because I watched it and thought it was fun, thought The Doctor's Daughter, you know, Davo's own daughter, was quite cheeky and fun. But yeah, it's absolutely loathed. It's really quite crazy. But look, I'll also pull out that, you know, Chris talks about the classic era and it was harder to judge other reactions from fans, and, you know, every story will have its champions. I think we find that when we record, you know, our primary sources episodes, we read letters from people saying things, you don't expect to hear based on, you know, conventional fan wisdom. Yet you go back to the source in a magazine from 1983 or 87 or 92 or whatever, and it's like, oh, look, there's someone actually saying the complete opposite to what you think someone from that era would say. So, yes, very true, Chris.
I remember when we were doing the Goodies Pirate podcast, going through every episode of the Goodies, and we discovered it is literally, absolutely, factually true. Every episode is somebody's favourite, because every time we did an episode on something, no matter how much sometimes we, all four of us on the show might say we didn't like it, someone would write in and say, this is my favourite. So everybody has a favourite out there, and it's different for everybody.
They sure do. Let's move on to the human palindrome. It's our mate Mark Cockrum, who also has the All of Time and Space podcast with Ian Martin. Do listen to it, folks.
Yes,
he wrote to us on Twitter and said, the one that really sticks out the most for me is The Rings of Akatan. I loved that they tried to do something really different, using music as part of the story and the attempt at world building with all the alien species. Then I saw in some cases the pure, undiluted loathing aimed at it, and I was quite taken aback. Sure, I appreciate it's not for everyone, but the sheer level of vitriol being thrown around was quite astonishing.
So, mea culpa.
Yes.
I am probably broadly on the bandwagon there that Mark is describing. I hope I was not vitriolic about it, but I certainly was on the anti-Akatan bandwagon at the time. And whilst I certainly appreciate that they were trying to do something different, and the opening stuff isn't too bad, for me, any episode of New Who that ends with the Doctor making a big wanky speech instantly gets a big tick.
Freudian.
instantly gets a big cross from me. It's a style and a tone of the show I just can't stand, and that combined with the cheesy graphics of the giant smiling pumpkin, it just left a really bad taste in my mouth. So yes, maybe I hope I wasn't vitriolic, but I certainly wasn't that bandwagon, Mark. You are absolutely right to call us all out for that, because there are always people who do enjoy it, and you clearly enjoyed this one.
I gave this some thought when Mark sent us the tweet, and you know what I think it is, at least for me, and it could be for other people too, that Smith as a doctor is a doctor I really like, but so many of his episodes and stories just weren't hitting the mark for me. And I had that problem with Capaldi as well. But with regard to Smith, I think it was that from week to week, I was like, oh, I didn't like that story, but Smith was great. Next week, oh, I really didn't like that story, but Smith was great. And I think when you get to an episode like this, and you've just been so disappointed by so many episodes, you can see that they're trying to do something new. You can see it's different. Of course, we're all watching the same thing. But you just think to yourself, Jesus Christ, we can't even get a regular episode right, and now we're off on these flights of fancy trying to do all this weird shit. Why? Why? What are you doing over there, you know, BBC or showrunner or whoever you want to blame the episode on? And that's where I think some of my frustration with this came out, that I was just not enjoying a lot of his stories. And here was one that really pushed the boat out. And it was like, no, let's get the basics right before we do this. This is bloody ridiculous. So that's how I felt about it. And it was born of other issues, I guess.
Yeah, it's very true that the mood you are in collectively as you watch a series can definitely play on how you enjoy individual episodes. I was somebody who enjoyed most of the Capaldi seasons quite a lot. And as such, there are episodes that others didn't enjoy, but I kind of was just carried through by my enjoyment of Capaldi. There's, as you say, in the Smith era, there's stuff that I probably would have liked had I just watched it in an isolated fashion. But after three or four Smiths I really didn't enjoy, a kind of okay story becomes a not very okay story, just because you're just in a bad mood and you're not connecting with the series. And I think that's why we hear from a lot of casual viewers and a lot of casual fans, or people who discovered episodes out of context. They're just one day randomly thrown on that episode of the show for the first time, and they judge it very individually, not as episode 5 of series whatever.
Yeah, that's it.
Now, I've got a couple of different examples to give you now, Rob, of my own.
Ooh, okay.
Partly because some of the ones that I had were taken by our listeners and I wanted to defer to them, but I was thinking about, are there any classic stories that this is really the case for? And I certainly remember the McCoy era going out, but generally speaking, my views in that era were kind of in sync with fandom. I enjoyed them, didn't enjoy them, or was ambivalent to what most people were at the time. And then I remember that there are Hartnell stories where there was no collective fan wisdom I was aware of, because either I wasn't part of fandom or fandom just had no opinion on these at the time. So two stories that I remember listening to as a boy, we're talking under the age of 10, and I thought both the Web Planet and the Celestial Toymaker were just these wonderful, creative, interesting, exciting adventures with alien worlds and alien beings and whatever it is that the Toymaker is. And in the case of the Toymaker, every episode was a different threat and a different game and a different concept. Mm-hmm. In the Web Planet, I would listen to the soundscape of Vortis and I'd see pictures of the Zabi, and I just thought these are really capturing my imagination. And as I got older and I did work out that there was a fan consensus about these, that fan consensus was that they were both terrible and boring and dull and about as the Hartnell era could get. And so I disagree with both of those. I don't think that they are, either of them are probably now in my top half of the Hartnell era, but I enjoy them both for what they are. But I just thought that was a very different example of where I've enjoyed something and then discovered later on that collectively fandom doesn't.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Celestial Toymaker, because that's one I discovered not through audio, but through the novelization, which must have came out, I don't know, 88, 89, that 90, thing, around then.
It was certainly towards the end of the Targets.
Yeah. And I read that and I thought, this is fabulous. I love this. This is Doctor Who. Wow. You know, in capital letters. And particularly more recently, I think some fans get very uptight about the celestial aspect and, oh, he's dressed in an Asian sort of way and he's not Asian and, we better tiptoe around this. And that colours some of their impressions of it. I know that there's probably, you know, one good episode out of the four. It's the one that exists, I think.
Yeah, I think it's definitely helped that probably the best episode of the story is the one that exists, and I suspect if episode 3, which is the dancing one, or the dancing slash hunt the key one, if that was the only one that existed, I would certainly have formed a different impression of this early on as well.
Yeah, you know, but you can, even then, you can see how that would have fitted into a rainy afternoon in the UK, you know, absolutely, with that on TV for 25 minutes. It's no big deal. But yeah, I do find some people get very, very uptight about this, almost in the same way they get uptight about Talons of Wang Chiang and so on. And I think, I think that's colouring them more than I think the story deserves in some ways, but maybe I'll stop there.
No, fair enough. Have you got another example or two for us, Rob?
I do. I have another example, and I've gone to the Tennant era for this. And my example is a story I thought was just a lot... Again, I thought this was a lot of fun. And then I go online and everyone hates it. It's New Earth. I thought, okay, sure, the finale where the Doctor mixes together all the drugs in the world and cures every disease, that's nonsense. I get that. But throughout the story, the cat nuns, I thought, looked fantastic. I thought the whole hospital idea was intriguing, the fact that the cats ran it. Cassandra came back and provided heaps of humour in particular, especially with the body swapping that goes on. But then some real sadness too when we look back on her life. And again, like earlier stories, I'm not saying for a moment this is brilliant. I'm not saying it's as even good as Father's Day, which was my previous example. But the way it gets panned, I don't get it at all. I think it's fine.
I can remember my main reaction to New Earth, having watched it all, shut the laptop, was to just sort of look in the sky and go, what was all that about?
Really?
And I don't think I watched it again for probably another 10 years or so. I really just sort of was quietly forgotten by me. I don't think I loved it or hated it. I just didn't quite get it and forgot about it.
Wow.
Shall I read another one from our listeners?
That would be fantastic.
So this is from another contributor, Dwayne Bunny at Earth Shadows, via Twitter, I assume. And he says, I really enjoyed Love and Monsters. Why it's still hated so much today is a mystery to me. After all, David Tennant is hardly in it, and that indeed is a blessing. Loving the show, guys.
That's fantastic.
Thank you for that, Dwayne.
Yeah, look, thank you, Dwayne, and do listen to Dwayne's podcast, The Sirens of Audio, which covers a lot of Big Finish material. We've spoken about Love and Monsters earlier, so I've got nothing to add there myself.
No, likewise. I think we'll just let that comment stand.
I'll move on with our mate Stephen B. Steed Stylin on the Twitters, who also does the New to Who podcast. He says, I was shocked upon entering fandom many years after it aired that Series 2 was not considered the height of New Who. Winky face. But in all seriousness, the smug stick that Ten and Rose got hit with is something I truly don't get. Series 2 is Doctor Who doing a romantic love story. Live with it. One of the strengths of Doctor Who is that it can be anything. Whether that's presenting the Doctor as a war survivor with PTSD, the old man in a young body, the hero who wants to resort to violence, the Machiavellian schemer, or the exile. It's all Doctor Who doing new things, but still being Doctor Who.
That is absolutely true, Steve. And the great thing about the series is that probably not everybody's going to love everything the show does, but the fact that it does so much means that a lot of people will love a lot of it. And that's often the case. I love the hero who never resorts to violence. I love the Machiavellian schemer. I love the old man in the young body. I don't love the Doctor as romantic comedy or romantic lead. It's not for me, but that's okay. Something else comes across, you know, sooner rather than later, and that's okay.
Yeah, and this does tie back into stuff we've already covered when we talk about the Doctor Who can be anything, like Rings of Akatan. Let's bring in the kids' choir and they can have a sing. Yeah, I get that. I get that Doctor Who can do that. It's just whether it fits, maybe, with what else is going on as to whether you personally like it or not.
And sometimes it really does depend on whether you're in the moment or not.
Yeah.
A great example, I think, is Delton the Manor Man. If you're waiting for a year or so for a new series of Doctor Who to come in, you're very worried if the show's going to continue, you're not quite sure about this new Doctor, you're really not sure about Bonnie Langford, and suddenly you get, you know, Time of the Rani, Paradise Tales, and Delton the Bannerman. I remember it was very hard to like Delton the Bannerman. Now, if you're just sitting back on a rainy afternoon, you think, I just want some absolute easy watching fun. You can put on Delton the Bannerman and enjoy it for what it is. So I think out of context, that works a lot better than it does in context. And that's the case with a lot of New Who, I think.
Yeah, agree with that.
We now have an email from regular correspondent Millie McKenzie.
We do. This is a long one, so I'm going to sit back, Dave, and let you read.
Oh, thank you very much. Millie says, Hi, Rob and Dave. Millie McKenzie here. I have a long list of episodes I really loved and watched multiple times, then later discovered they were largely disliked, in some cases utterly despised, by everyone else. These are the ones that immediately jumped to my mind, but I'm sure there are loads more. Classics, The Invisible Enemy, The Androids of Tara, and the entire season of Trial of a Time Lord. Modern, The Idiot's Lantern, Let's Kill Hitler, The Wedding of Riversong, Last Christmas, Hellbent, The Saranga Conundrum, Praxis, my first correspondence with you, I think. I was so appalled by how much you trashed it. And The Timeless Children. On the flip side, I can't stand Human Nature Family of Blood. I don't enjoy The Girl in the Fireplace at all, except for the brilliantly creepy clockwork droids, and Journey's End makes me feel ill. The Saranga Conundrum. How often is it that we encounter an unstoppable alien entity that is not evil? They always want to kill the Doctor or take over the world, but even more ridiculously, the universe. Why? Because they are evil and that's what evil things do. Give me a break. The Pating was simply a wild animal who's hungry. And he's so cute. I know fans have this issue where they don't like to be reminded that they love a children's program, which I imagine is the main reason they all seem to hate this episode. Honestly, there is just so much in this episode that deals with mature themes that you can enjoy even if the monster isn't your cup of tea. The relationship between Eve and her brother is masterfully written. Eve sacrifices herself to save everyone. Dirkus knows it will kill her to pilot the ship, but he has to let her go. There were such lovely moments of character between Ryan and Yoz, as Ryan struggles to understand why his dad left and encourages Yoz to embrace fatherhood, even though it is scary. The sets are absolutely gorgeous, the story is really strong, and the threat is unique. I love that the resolution is not to destroy this creature, because what right does anybody have to kill an innocent animal just because their presence is an inconvenience? This leads to quite possibly the most joyous, enchanting, and heartwarming moment in all of Doctor Who's history, where the Pating's little body absorbs the bomb. He's just eaten the most delicious, satisfying Christmas dinner ever, and the smile on his wee face as he floats through space makes me blubber uncontrollable happy tears every time I watch it. Well, thank you for that, Millie. There's a lot to go through there. I agree with you. I don't think the Saranga Conundrum deserves the hate it's get. I thought it was a bit dull, but it's okay. I will call you out for not being able to stand my all-time favourite story from New Who, Human Nature. That's okay. We can disagree on that one. But a really good analysis there of why that's perhaps a story that deserves a bit more attention.
Yeah, it's one I think about going back to from time to time. I'm not quite ready for it. But it's one I certainly watched and wasn't over the moon with it. And then as I heard more and more commentary on it, I might have, you know, even been swayed by that to some degree. Similar to how we've reviewed some Star Wars movies, like our hot take, like, oh, we just saw this at the midnight screening and I thought, well, this was good and this was bad and this was good and that was bad. And then over the next month or two, you start hearing critiques where people pull it apart and you start to realize, oh, it does seem worse than I thought it was. This is one of those examples where the more I heard about it, the more I thought, yeah, I don't think I liked that. So I think I need to go back and reevaluate perhaps.
Yeah, and that's a really good example of something I wanted to bring up over the course of this conversation, which is that bandwagon effect. And I think both the Saranga Conundrum and Orphan 55 a year later, and probably the Battle of Rascal Avkolos were all ones that got sort of, you know, lukewarm to mild to negative reviews, but they kind of became the whipping boy for fandom, and it just became really trendy and cool to sink the boot into them, particularly on social media. And that's not to say that they were brilliant episodes that were being unfairly, you know, given negative reviews, but yeah, there sometimes is this bandwagon where it just becomes trendy to make sure everybody knows that you also don't like this story.
Although in some cases, I sometimes read a critique or watch a review on YouTube and I think, gosh, that person's actually encapsulated what I was thinking, but they've just done it better, and I get on board with them. This doesn't always happen. Sometimes I watch reviews, I think, I do genuinely think, was this person watching the same thing as me? Because they seem to loathe it and, you know, want to take a flamethrower to it, and I thought it was perfectly fine. So it doesn't happen all the time, but once in a while it does happen, whether with Doctor Who or a Star Wars film or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it's just human nature sometimes to want to be in with the cool crowd, and that's the case with Doctor Who as well sometimes as well, yeah.
Maybe. I will now read from Facebook. This is Jeff Waddell, our great mate Jeff Waddell, up in Scotland. He says, I'm surprised at the positive reaction to Capaldi's finale. An absolute disaster from start to finish, in my opinion. We get an impression of Hartnell by Bradley, which is so far removed from the First Doctor it's actually offensive. Add that to there being no reason for the two to meet at all, which diminishes Hartnell's regeneration. Throw in a member of the Brigadier's family, and worst of all, Rusty, the all-singing, all-dancing Dalek. Give me strength. It's a bloody shambles of a story, and sums up the Capaldi era for me. A brilliant Doctor, mostly wasted in stories that don't serve him well, and thus I don't enjoy his era at all.
I agree with much of what Jeff said there, so I don't have much to add, I'm afraid.
Do you know, the only thing I disagree with Jeff on is that he is surprised at the positive reaction to the finale. My thought was that most people were fairly nonplussed by it, and I thought most people thought, ooh, I think he would have done better to have regenerated in the previous story. It was a much more dramatic, big sort of thing. This is a bit fluffy. You know, I thought there wasn't really a positive reaction to it.
I think this was one story where the reaction was very fragmented, depending on what corner of fandom you were in. And I think corners that are mostly inhabited by fans of our generation who grew up on John Pertwee repeats were a lot more down on this than fans of the new series, who embraced the new series in a bigger way and saw this as being a celebration of the Capaldi era, who really love concepts like Rusty, the all-singing, all-dancing Dalek. You know, if you like those things and you see them referenced, then this is going to be a great celebration of the era. If you're not a fan of those sort of things, then it is a very difficult summation of the era.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I'll give you my last two examples before we get into yours and then some final thoughts from our listeners. And another one where I was very surprised by how negatively this story was perceived by fandom. It's from Series 2. It's a David Tennant story. Mm-hmm. And this was set in the wonderful past in the 1950s. Rose wasn't able to speak for most of this, which after several episodes of Smug Rose, I thought was just enough to give this a strong pass regardless. Yeah. There's a really interesting villain, a really interesting concept, a couple of really cool guest stars, a really touching little subplot, I thought, with the young boy in the story. This is, of course, The Idiot's Lantern. I thought this is perhaps the best of Gaddis's scripts for Doctor Who, certainly on TV. I thought this was just sort of wonderful on every level. It left, you know, really hit me in the feels. You know, Doctor Who doesn't often hit me in the feels, but this one really did hit me in the feels. And I thought this is everything that fans of New Who are going to love. And I'm really looking forward to being, you know, totally on board with these New Who fans that love the feels and RTD and all that sort of thing. I'm going to be part of the crowd on this one. And they all hated it.
I think you really like the subplot, Dave, and I think the subplot is something a lot of people probably don't even think about.
Yeah, I think it's very possible. And that's not unusual for a lot of stories where one aspect can really hit one viewer and not hit another. But even then, I still think that The Wire is a really well-conceived and executed villain. And I guess there are some fans who will say they didn't enjoy it, but comment that The Wire itself was cool.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I thought I was going to be in with the crowd on this one and was really surprised, and still am to this day, that I'm not.
Well, I'm surprised you thought that, because it's a Gator story, and he's like a coin toss at best when it comes to his stuff.
Well, true, but this was only the second Gator episode. We hadn't realised we hadn't realised how Marmite Gator was going to be at this stage.
Right, I'm looking back in hindsight, aren't I? Yeah,
for sure. Okay. And another one is an episode that, Rob, you and I did the review of,
yeah,
and we tore this episode to pieces. We said that the concept was completely wasted. We said it was on a small scale that should have been bigger. We said that the guest characters were just stupid. The resolution was done really ham-fistedly. There was no resolution for the villain. We absolutely demolished this one. We said consistently that this was the worst in the series. Every episode of the series we reviewed after it, we used this as the stick against which, you know, it's not as bad as Arachnids in the UK, was a theme for the rest of that series. And although it's not loved, it's liked a lot better than we ever thought it was.
Yeah, and they're even bringing the guy back in a few days' time.
They're bringing the guy back in a few days' time. They are.
Yeah, look, again, it's an example where I think there is a lot of hate for it, but some people do say, oh, no, that was fantastic. Again, were we watching the same thing? Did you think it was great that the Doctor locked up all the spiders just to suffocate? Did you think it was great that the baddie got away scot-free? Like, huge environmental vandalism, growing huge spiders, really messing stuff up, and just walks away.
As I said at the time, this was an episode that promised us arachnids in the UK and gave us a few dull spiders in an empty hotel.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, I'm having flashbacks now. I think my comment at the time, why didn't they even just cut to outside and show them running over the city in a creepy way? We didn't even get that.
No, so look, we are still tearing this one apart.
we better stop.
This is still the benchmark, I think, the low point for us, or certainly the Whittaker era, but it gets a bit of love out there, so that's interesting.
So, Dave, for my last example, I'm going to change tack now, because the return of Dr. Mysterio is one that seemed to be quite liked at the time and around this time of year, particularly in the lead up to Christmas. It was getting trotted out a lot. People were you know, posting pictures from it and saying how much they like it, and it is a Christmas episode. I just think it's garbage. I think Doctor Who trying to do superheroes, and not just superheroes, but a really cliched superhero, that's not trying to do anything new or clever. It's just a really cliched superhero. Like, why? It's jarring. It doesn't fit. I didn't like the humour. I was very underwhelmed and annoyed with the episode. And again, every Christmas season, people seem to pop up and say how great it is. Or they really raise my blood pressure by saying it's so good, it's better than, say, A Christmas Carol, which I think is just definitive Doctor Who Christmas sort of content. I don't get this one at all. I watched it that, oh my God, make it end. This is horrible.
I certainly liked it more than I like most Christmas specials, but that's not setting a very high standard. And to be
damning
honest,
with faint praise.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't really remember it. I certainly remember us reviewing it, and I remember thinking it was okay, but it's faded from the memory, and it's not one I've had any desire to go back and watch, I'm afraid.
Oh, there was a rom-com angle, and he was babysitting the kid, and but he was also the superhero, right. And oh my god.
No, most now you say that I remember it, but most of it's just sort of faded from the memory. It happened.
Yeah,
probably. That's about all I can say.
To be. Alrighty, you've got one.
I have, from Philip Edney, who tweets at Edney Philip.
And is also the other half of Sirens of Audio.
He says, as a kid, I loved, and still do, Warriors of the Deep.
Yay!
Yay, good call. I love the Silurian and Sea Devil costumes. I love the political undercurrent. We were all in fear of nuclear war back then. I thought it ambitious and even liked the Mirka. Everyone dies. Great. Criticism still feels overblown. I am glad you raised that one because I totally agree with everything you said there. As a kid, this was everything I wanted Doctor Who to be. Bright metal, flashing lights, monsters, action, high stakes. This was a regularly watched story on video for me as a kid. I can see the production flaws now, but I don't think that it is nearly as bad as conventional wisdom holds.
It's one of those stories, isn't it, where whenever someone talks about it, particularly if they're being disparaging, they'll always bring up the same one or two points. Perhaps the acting of Ingrid Pitt, or perhaps the Mirka. And I sometimes, when I hear this on other podcasts or, you know, on YouTube videos, I want to crawl into that podcast and say, tell me more about the story. What else do you actually know about it? What else do you actually perhaps remember about it? Or are you just relying on these tired old cliches about it? And this could really apply across the board to all these episodes people are talking about where they get panned. You know, what if someone said to me, what else can you tell me about the story? You know, I think back to Millie's comments. She saw great depth in Saranga Conundrum with regards to relationships between people who I might not give a second thought with regard to their relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it comes down to it, particularly over time, 5, 10, 15, 20 years go by, do we tend to fall back on what we remember the worst of it being and don't really give everything its full due, whether in a positive way or maybe in a negative way?
Yes, I'll agree with everything you just said. I think you're right.
Okay. I waxed lyrical there a bit, I think.
No, look, you did, and I think you've summed it up perfectly well.
Alrighty. I'll move on. We have a short one here from our good mate Ian Martin, who is another half of the All in Time and Space podcast. Sometimes gives us episodes too, Dave, the Doctor Who A to Z. I'd really like one of those, Ian, if you're in the neighbourhood. He says, I don't get why everyone else hated Orphan 55. I thought it was great.
Well, look, you're on your own there, I think, Ian. That's a very good example of one where you're going against mainstream fandom. Rob and I did a long episode on why we didn't think it was very good not that long ago, and I don't want to tread over that ground again. If you enjoyed it, that's awesome. I'm, you know, genuinely interested in that choice.
Yeah, the most charitable I can be is it had promise.
Look, there was definitely some interesting ideas there and there was some nice filming there. I just thought it was a mess and it had some annoying characters and some annoying moments. But look, this goes back to what we were saying half an hour ago, Rob. Everybody likes something in Doctor Who. You know, every episode's got its fans.
Absolutely. And here we go with our final comment.
Yes, so this is from Owen Prince, who tweets at Kellogg's24 and is a regular correspondent with us on the Twitter. Owen says, I'm always surprised by the positive feeling towards the Happiness Patrol. I personally love it and for a long time thought I was the only one. Yeah, it has a dark story and the Thatcherism reflected throughout is almost dripping off the walls. But it's a fun jaunt and appears to have found fans since it first aired. I was all of 8 at the time, so I have no recollection of how it was received. All I know is I was taken by it and have been a fan ever since. Plus, 7 is my doctor, so... and that's from Owen. And he and I must be very close to the same age if he saw it when he was first 8, assuming that was first broadcast, of course.
Yeah.
I think that Owen is correct. This was very broadly dismissed by most of fandom
yes.
at the time because of the costumes and the wigs and the campy nature of it.
Oh, painting the TARDIS pink, Dave, was...
Yes.
I can't express this enough without sounding like I'm being over the top, but it was heresy. It was insane. You don't paint the TARDIS pink, full stop, was the attitude.
There was a big pylon on the Candyman, all of that sort of thing, and I think Owen is quite right. Over time, its fans have been more comfortable in saying that they liked it, but it's also found many more fans as people have worked out actually what the story was doing and what the story was saying and how it was doing and saying that. And I think a lot of people have come to appreciate it far, far more over time. But it's still not one that if you said to people, what are the best McCoy stories, this wouldn't get in many people's top five.
No, probably not. It actually makes mine, and that's an example of someone who's come around to it. At the time, I was 13 years old when this came out in 88, and I went with the flow. I was like, yeah, you cannot paint the TARDIS pink, you know, the have a nice death, and all this. Oh, like, what the hell is this? This is bloody stupid, you know? I cannot stand this. Now I think this is great. This is absolutely fine. This is 80s Doctor Who to me. It's wonderful. But at the time, yeah, fans did not like it, and I was one of them.
I didn't have any strong feelings on it at the time. I was about 8 as well when it came out. And it was okay, but it wasn't one with Daleks and it wasn't the one with Cybermen. So it kind of, you know, fell below those and it was more understandable than Greatest Show in the Galaxy. So it was above that. And that's about, you know, all I really thought as an 8-year-old. But now, yeah, I think it's just an amazing piece of television.
Yeah. Well, look, should we sum things up? I fear I might have shot my bolt about 5 minutes ago with my waxing lyrical. Dave, do you have any closing thoughts on this as a whole?
The two points I would make, the first is very simplistic and it's just a repeat of what we've previously said, which is that Doctor Who is very, very different and every time it does something different, it will work for some and not for others, and every story is somebody's favourite. I think we've been very clearly demonstrated that here. And the other thing I'll say is that I think that we cannot pretend that Doctor Who doesn't exist now in a world of instant reaction and social media pylons. And sometimes when a show starts to get a bit of a bad rep, you see, particularly on Twitter, sometimes on message boards, I believe, but as I say, I don't go to those more often, sometimes on Facebook posts, people will just start to really get that group think and really pile on. And it takes a while for shows sometimes to emerge from underneath that social media groupthink and really find their place in a more deserved way in fandom's collective wisdom. It's going to be very interesting, I think, to look back at stories like Arachnid Saranga, Orphan 55, Praxeus, those ones that have had fans and detractors instantly, and some of which have been favourite targets for pylons. And to see in 10 years' time, do they become like the Happiness Patrol and be more appreciated for what they are?
Yeah, I think, you know, to play on off what you're saying there and also what I was saying earlier, I challenge all of our listeners, you know, if you haven't watched Love and Monsters for 10 years or whatever, and you think it's all that horrible episode that you didn't like, why not go back and watch it now? Challenge yourself. Challenge your own opinions. And see what you think, particularly if it's been a while since you've seen something. Absolutely.
No, there are definitely very many stories that my view has maybe not gone from loathing to loving, but certainly softened and mellowed, and I've learned to appreciate what others are looking for in it. Sometimes it's not the case, but there's a lot of Doctor Who out there, so there's stuff for everybody.
Yeah, and even that stuff in the middle ground. You know, for many years, I thought Horror of Fang Rock was a middle ground sort of story. And then our good mates at 42 to Doomsday would sort of name drop Horror of Fang Rock in every episode almost as like a joke. I mean, they love the episode, but they would always reference it. It's one of their touchstones. And then one day I went back and watched it and I thought, yeah, this is actually better than I thought it was. It is actually very, very good. So, you know, even when something's in the middle ground, again, challenge yourself.
Absolutely. I think that's a good point to leave our main topic on. But we have got several more emails off topic this time, Rob.
We do indeed. Shall you lead off, Dave?
Yeah, so the first comes in from Doc Hoom, who has been a co-host on the show once or twice and obviously hosts or co-hosts the Diddly Dumb podcast. He's referring here to an email on our last monthly podcast. Your correspondent, JT, suggests you ask for examples of Doctor Who for virgins. So, Can I suggest the 1986 episode of Open Air, where Chris Chibnall and members of the Merseyside Doctor Who Appreciation Society set out their vision for the show? That's what always springs to my mind when anyone mentions Doctor Who for virgins. Best wishes, Doc Whom. Very funny. I like that.
Very good. This one comes from Rog Blake, also known as John. He says, "Hi guys, I'm really enjoying Primary Sources. It's great to get flashes of memory and insight. I just listened to the July 91 episode with the bit about City of Death, and you wondering when the last time the writer could have watched the story. It's a lot sooner than you thought. In 1986, British Satellite Broadcasting, BSB, launched with their infamous Squareal, a square aerial that was mounted on the house like a Who Diamond logo. One of the shows on its Galaxy channel was Doctor Who from the start. They would devote whole weekends to the show with J&T and other crew and cast appearances." And here he's given us a link to the TARDIS wiki talking about Doctor Who weekend on BSB. He says, "In 1990, they merged with Sky TV to become BSkyB. The show was moved to a channel called UK Gold, who would show omnibus cuts on Sunday mornings for years." And I'll just break in and say, we had similar out here. We did have the UK Gold channel on Foxtel back in the 90s, and that's where I taped onto VHS a lot of Hartnell stories.
Yeah, so, and there were certainly off-air dubs from the UK Gold in the UK that were being swapped with stories that we had on video here. So, yes, they were definitely circulating around in the 90s. I remember that.
Yeah. John goes on, "So by July 91, I had a healthy collection of off-air stories recorded to VHS. I'm sure City of Death was shown regularly. It was a BSkyB weekend celebrating the first 10 years that got me back into the show. And I bet Dave would like to know it was the William Hartnell story, The Space Museum."
Oh, very cool.
"One of my earliest memories of watching The Doctor is City of Death, so for me, it's golden. However, this made me the perfect age for Davo, and I even enjoy Warriors from the Deep." That's good. "P.S. Have you watched the new version of All Creatures Great and Small? If so, what do you think? All the best from John." I'll jump in there because it's probably primarily for me, because I've talked about All Creatures Great and Small on just about every episode this year. I have not seen the new series. I knew it was coming. I haven't sourced it through nefarious means, although I know it has aired over in the UK. It might currently be on a streaming service or on, I don't know, Foxtel or something out here that I don't have. It's certainly not on any of the streaming services I do have. So I've not seen it. I hear good things about it. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, I'm assuming it's going to get an Australian broadcast at some point. And if that doesn't happen soon, I might have to acquire it through other means. But for the moment, I'm waiting for it to come out here. Otherwise, yeah, look, some very interesting thoughts there. And yeah, good to point out the whole UK Gold thing. I've actually got a very good friend of mine who's now retired, but was the guy sent in to clean up BSkyB when it was failing horribly in the mid-90s. So I have a few inside stories about that. But yeah, no, that was a good example. We did forget about that.
Yeah, and it also brings to mind, you know, we talk about tape swapping and stuff. I remember tape swapping happening 87, 88, 89, 90, like those sort of years for me. But it seems that in the UK, you know, by the early 90s, UK fans were actually building up little collections of their own, you know, without the BBC doing repeats and stuff. We kind of think they just went on for all eternity without repeats. But by the early 90s, they did have them.
They did, although the service there was a very, very niche and quite expensive service, I think. So
that is true too.
But they were circulating, yes. Another email here from Shane Roth. "Hello, I haven't written to you two delightful chaps for a while and just wanted to send my salutations for the festive season 2020, a year none of us will forget for a while. I've enjoyed your shows this year, including your alternative galaxy stuff and the new DWM letters segment. I had a suggestion for a show which seemed relevant for this year, with the drama of the US election. However, I didn't send it in when I heard, at the end of one of your recent shows, that you already had the rest of 2020 mapped out. But here it is now. I have a particular interest in politics. As a fairly long-time listener, I'm aware Dave works in or for a political something or someone. I know Doctor Who has been very political in its time, at times. Look at the Let's era alone. I am also astonished by the reach the show has, even across the political divide. I myself am quite left-leaning, not far left, but very progressive in the Bernie Sanders, AOC, etc. field. Now, I've always thought my political affiliation tied in with the vibe of the show, and maybe the show itself affected my political view. And then I see someone like George Christensen, a very conservative federal MP in Australia, is a fan too. I don't quite get how we can watch the same show and come away with such opposing views. To me, this is what the world needs more of. Instead of getting entrenched in our opposing camps and the us versus them mentality that so many of us are victim to, we need to remember that we are all members of one human race. For all that divides us, there is so much that combines us, and Doctor Who is just one of them. Plus, in not only discussing Doctor Who's history with real-world politics, what about its own fictional way that it has depicted politics? You know, unit of security at peace deals between world powers, foreshadowing a female PM, or even the political leanings of the established PMs. For example, why did people swing from seemingly left-leaning Harriet Jones towards, one presumes, a more conservative Harold Saxon? And piled on top of that, there's the other real-world aspect of known politicians who admire or follow the show and have referenced it at times to emphasise their own point, though that may require levels of research you just may not care for. What's the appeal of the show to such a broad, disparate political audience? I know this last point is a bit speculative because you can't presume to know why some people like it, but anyway. So, a bit like your podcast on Doctor Who and its relationship with the LGBTQ, which was really interesting, just wondering if you'd find doing a Doctor Who and politics episode as interesting. I'll leave it for your consideration, and once again, wishing both you and yours the best for the festive season and into 2021. P.S. Rob, if you're doing another video Xmas message this year, I'm the bloke who replied last year from a very sunny Bendigo, Shane.
I do remember that. I cracked out my camera and just started making a wacky video, and some people replied to it. Shane was one of them. I might do it again this year. We'll see.
So, in reply to Shane, obviously, yes. Yeah, we'll certainly consider the idea. One of the reasons why it probably won't happen soon is that I actually guested on the 42 to Doomsday podcast, I think about 3 years ago now, and we actually did exactly this topic, talking about exactly the things that Shane's referring to there. So it would be a bit of old ground for me. But I do encourage you to check that one out. We did a follow-up last year on Doctor Who and religion, and we're planning one next year on Doctor Who and the military. It's sort of a bit of a threesome there. So check that out. But to give Shane, just if I can, Rob, a couple of sort of very quick comments on what he's saying. The first is, I think that any show that is wanting to have a mainstream audience of 5, 8, 10 million viewers is going to be watched simply by a lot of people who vote in a lot of different ways, and frankly by a lot of people who aren't following politics and don't have strong vibes one way or the other. And I think that for the show to go down any one partisan political direction would be at the detriment of the audience, and you know that's not good for a mainstream, just sort of fun family show, you know, not like The West Wing, where it is being watched by political junkies. This is just, you know, Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon viewing, whatever the case may be. In terms of the leaning of the show, I think it's wrong to think of it as being either a left or right show, because we really define now left and right in economic terms about how we raise taxes, how we spend taxes, all that sort of thing. And the show outside of The Sunmakers doesn't address that. I do think that, though, is there is a very clear vibe of classical liberal or Gladstonian liberal philosophy that does arc through the show, and in different countries, different parties are the custodians of that philosophy. Sometimes it stretches across parties, depending on the makeup there. But there are certainly themes of the value of the individual. There are themes of the value of multinationalism. There are themes of all sorts of things that are not, you know, Labour, Liberal, Conservative, Democrat, Republican, Christian, Democrat, whatever. They're broader than that, and I think that's why there is a broader appeal to the show. And the final point is that there obviously is not a consistent vibe to the show, because as Shane points out, it's got many different eras, and often it's driven by the values or the points or the themes that the production team of the time want to make. You look at the BBC in the 1960s, and it's a very conservative institution, although people like Verity Lambert were quite radical within that. It was still very establishment. We've spoken on our John Pertwee episode, retrospective, Rob, about how you've got a very sort of big L liberal in Barry Letts, and you've got a small-C conservative in Terence Dix, and you've got a retired former communist in Malcolm Hulk, and when they all sort of bring their values into the mix, you get some really wonderful stories like Colony in Space or The Invasion of the Dinosaurs that do have these values in there. And I think that Colony in Space is a great example of where this isn't about the left or the right or politics or anything. It's just about how we value each other as a society. And indeed, that show being made at the time is all about how wonderful these colonists are escaping from the rat race and getting out there and doing all these sort of wonderful things against the might of the corporate. If you were making that show now, it would almost certainly be about the folly of the colonialists and their relationship with the indigenous populations, because that is something that we are much more aware of and is in the political zeitgeist now. That would be a very different show now.
Yeah. And look, even when people think they've got the measure of the show, even when people were looking at Whittaker's first season and saying, oh, look at Doctor Who now, it's super woke, there's a woman in the lead role and it's all woke topics and it's this and it's that. You then go and have an episode like Kablam, where the upshot is that the big Amazon-type company that's really bad to its employees is actually the one we're going to side with, and it's the freedom fighter who's the dickhead and who we're going to off. So even when people thought they had the measure of the show, it still goes and does things like that in some stories.
And that's the final point I want to raise as well, which is you can sometimes be on very dangerous ground looking too hard for meaning in a show which, as Terence Dick says, half the time all they were trying to do was make sure the BBC didn't put the test card out at 5:30 on Saturday. And the best example of that, I think, came in the first series of The Revival with The Unquiet Dead, which after that aired, a number of people, particularly Lawrence Miles, pointed out that this could actually be interpreted as a really quite horrible, racist, anti-immigrant, anti-refugee polemic, in that it is all about this idea that people come along, they say they're helpless refugees, we let them into our country, and they turn out to actually be monsters. Once you read that interpretation of The Unquiet Dead, it's hard not to see it. Mm. But we're fortunate that Gatiss, who wrote it, is alive and, you know, is someone we know, and was very quick to say, oh my God, that's not what I meant at all. It was just a story about alien monsters. Like, you know, don't read that into it, please, please, please. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people in the 60s and 70s who we can't say, did you really mean this? And they go, no, where are you pulling that from?
Mm.
But I think that's just a great example of where you can sometimes look too hard for political meaning in the show as well. So that's a very quick summary for Shane.
Yes. I also have a comment of my own.
Please, yes.
Which I'll keep brief. Earlier this week, we were talking, a few of us on Twitter, but particularly myself and Millie McKenzie, about fans who are going out and doing dickish things online. The main example being people have already gone out and reviewed Revolution of the Daleks at Amazon, even though it's not out yet, because with so few reviews out there, because people obviously aren't reviewing it because it's not out, their review will sit at the top and they go and say horrible things about the show, and then their review just gets to sit as the number one review. And it's a tactic used across all sorts of fandoms, movies and so on. And it's dickish behavior. Millie said, you know, these people, do they not learn a thing from the Doctor? And I thought, this is my chance to talk about it on the show. But I will keep it brief because I know we're running over a bit. My thoughts on this, to Millie and all of you out there, are I think people take out of Doctor Who what they want to take out. And they see what they want to see. I think there are aspects of the Doctor's character who might appeal very much to someone who's left-leaning, to someone who's woke, whatever, and they'll say, look, there's the Doctor doing all these things I like, the show is obviously this, I love it. There may be someone on the completely opposite side of the fence who will pick out other aspects of the show and say, look, the show's doing this, so this is the show for me. They're not looking at the same thing, they're looking at the same show, but they're looking at different aspects completely of the same show and taking away different things. So I think that's, in a nutshell, very easily how people can all watch Doctor Who and be politically different and different in so many ways and go and argue about it on social media. I'll stop there. Dave, your thought?
No, I think that's all very true. And beyond that, there are some people who just tune in to watch the Dalek exterminate a lot of people tonight. And they're not thinking about work or politics or anything at all. And they're not watching the show in that way. So yeah, there are many different ways audiences interact with the show. As for the message of the show, I come back to what I've often said, which is, I think if I had to define the message of the show in one sentence, it's the First Doctor's line at the end of that wonderful story, The Ark, which is that you must travel with understanding as well as hope.
Absolutely.
So, we're getting towards the end of our show, but a couple of quick things that we wanted to mention. Rob, what have you been watching lately?
Dave, I've finished, finally, Jeremy Brett's Sherlock Holmes series. Very, very good stuff. I'll write a blog up about it one day. I've watched the new Grand Tour special, which is called A Massive Hunt.
Oh, yes.
Where they spend most of their time in Madagascar. And doesn't Madagascar look amazing? Wow, I would love to go there. And I also know that new episodes of The Expanse are out, but I haven't started to dig into them yet. The Expanse is just wonderful. And of course, we've both finished The Mandalorian, and we'll talk about it in the new year sometime. There are so many shows out there, Dave. I've probably missed half a dozen that I've watched in the last week or two.
I also watched A Big Hunt, and that was very, very entertaining. I kept gasping louder and louder as each new track of road sort of came into view, which was very good. One thing I did want to mention is that I haven't had a Foxtel subscription ever until last month when, because I wanted to watch the coverage and fallout of the US elections, I got a 3-month subscription to the Foxtel app to watch on my TV, which meant that I was also able to catch up on a couple of series that I haven't been able to before, including the reimagining, rebooting, whatever you want to call it, of Roswell.
Oh.
This is very interesting for me. So the reboot's called Roswell, New Mexico, to distinguish it from the original show Roswell in the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm. I've been enjoying it. I'm halfway through the existing episodes, and there's a new season coming later on, which I may have to get another month of Foxtel to get. I'll work that out when the time comes. Look, I really loved Roswell when I was much, much younger, and it's very interesting to me because back at the time, in the mid to late 90s, there wasn't much on. You know, Babylon 5 was really coming to an end by then. Buffy had probably peaked and was starting to come to an end by then, but I was watching that. And Roswell was the other really big one that I was into, and it only had 3 seasons. But it was a show that was very much something I desperately clung to in a very wilderness-like environment, as opposed to now, where, as you just said, Rob, there is so much on that it's very hard. You know, you actually have to make a commitment to say, right, I'm going to sit down over the next month or so and watch the 26 existing episodes of Roswell, New Mexico. And it was just, it was really interesting to me. They're doing it very, very differently. They were teenagers in the 90s version, and they have characters who some are similar to the other ones, some are completely new. You know, some were male and now female, some were straight and now gay, some were white and now Hispanic, or vice versa, which is all, you know, very interesting. But they're all about 10 years older now. It's about sort of people in their 20s, not people in their teens. And it's very, very 2020 in a way that the previous one was very, very 1995. But yeah, I've been enjoying that. And yes, I've obviously been enjoying The Mandalorian. That has been a genuine water cooler conversation at work.
Mm.
And I know that you and I and Richard have got some thoughts. We're keen to discuss on them. That will come out sometime early in the new year, we hope.
We're going to rip in on that one, I just think, just quietly. Yeah.
Speaking of the new year and things we've been doing, we have already recorded our January episode, which, Rob, you took a holiday from. We've given you your annual month off, and we recorded it here in person with the guys from 42 to Doomsday on the topics of conventions. So looking generally at conventions and how they've evolved, but drawing very particularly on our experiences of conventions here in Victoria and more generally in Australia to kind of tell that story. So that's coming out in January. And whilst we're all together, we did record the annual staff Christmas party episode of 42 to Doomsday, which I'm told by the time we drop this episode, that will be out. So please go check myself, Richard, Mark and Rob off on that one, where our main topic of conversation is where we basically nominated our very favourite Doctor Who stories for each of us to watch in lockdown and then come and discuss why they are so good.
Interesting. I hope they do Fanwank as well this year.
There is definitely Fanwank of the year. There are a few nominees for that. There is Target Book Club. There is a top three. I won't say what the top three topic is, but it is very related to 2020. Let me say that. Okay. Look, it was very fun to do, so please check that out. And check out our January episode on conventions coming in a month's time, which will include our hot take thoughts on Revolution of the Daleks recorded last week. We'll see how right we were.
Now, that is interesting, because we're still days away from that coming out, and you've already recorded your thoughts on it for that show.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that just leaves me to segue into our own review of Revolution of the Daleks, which will drop as soon as we see it here in Australia, and we can record an episode. So very, very early in the new year, just a few days from now, you'll be hearing us talking about it, whether we like it, whether we didn't like it. I already have thoughts on what I think it might be like, but I might keep them to myself for now.
Most of my predictions for the Chibnall era have been wildly off base. I'm not even going to bother. I'm going to go in and watch it January 2, I think we get it in Australia, so we'll record shortly after that.
Fantastic.
So lots of us coming over the next few weeks.
Yes, more than enough. More than enough for everybody. So Dave, look, compliments of the season to you. Hope you had a good Christmas and are going to have a great New Year.
Thank you very much, Rob, and to you and to Mrs. Rob and to all the listeners. All the best for 2021 and back to the Boxing Day test.
But until then, I've been Rob.
And I've been Dave.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to The Doctor Who Show, the podcast where too much Doctor Who is barely enough. Subscribe to us on iTunes or listen through the website at www.thedwshow.net. Write to us at hello@thedwshow.net or send us a quickie on Twitter @thedwshow. Facebook.com/thedwshow is also a good place to find us if you're so inclined. Our version of the Doctor Who theme arranged by George Locke. Look him up on YouTube, folks. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. Doctor Who, all names and sounds, and any other related items are trademarks and or copyrights of the BBC. All other trademarks and trade names are properties of their respective owners. The official Doctor Who website can be found at www.bbc.co.uk/Doctor Who.